session number 11364. Reel one.
Wing Commander Mitchell, Reel 1. You were telling me earlier about what you thought about the importance of Halton for the way in which the RAF performed in the war. Could you repeat what you were telling me then?
Well, yes, I think the Halton training proved itself for the people they turned out and during the war. Practically all the NCOs had been through the Halton course. It was a very tough course, but by jingo, it made you fit to take on anything in the world afterwards if you survived the course.
And of course you went to Halton yourself?
Yes, I went to Halton in September 1930 and left there in September 1933.
What kind of work were you doing when you first went into the RAF after Halton?
After Halton, I was a metal rigger on the Virginia bombers at Boscombe Down with No. 9 Squadron. And we then changed from the old Virginias, which rather dates me, to the new bombers, the Hayfords, that were coming out at the time.
Was it your ambition to fly yourself right from the beginning?
Yes, I wanted to become a pilot. And I thought to help me to get this pilot's course, I would try and be an air gunner. So I applied and I became an air gunner under training with the squadron and eventually went off and did a course at North Coast Fitties near Grimsby. I was successful in the course, but all it did for me, really, not speed up my pilot's course. Unfortunately, I was posted to India, really to relieve some of the chaps who had been in the earthquake at Quetta in 1936. And I went out and joined this Army Corporation Squadron, 31 Squadron, at Drigg Road at Karachi, where they were then based because of the Quetta earthquake. We spent a lot of time at Fort Sandeman, and I was then a full-time technician looking after an aeroplane and also the air gunner flying with the aeroplane.
How and when did you get your wings?
After 2.5 years, approximately 2.5 years in India, I went through a course of interviews and managed to be selected for a pilot's course in 1938. I came home to this country, the UK, and started training at Filton, the flying school there, and started to fly Tiger Moths. After successfully passing that course, I went along to Shawbury and continued my flying training with Oxford aircraft, twin-engine aircraft. Just as we, shortly after we'd qualified and were presented with our wings, war broke out. And I, together with many of the others, was posted to Blenheim Night Fighter Squadron, which were forming at that time.
What was your reaction to the outbreak of war?
Well, I happened to be duty pilot, being one of the senior pupils at Shawbury at the time. And when I got to the flying control that morning, I went to hear the Prime Minister declare war. And when I got back to flying control, pilots were coming in from all directions to go back to base. We had a few airplanes there from all over the country. And I couldn't get, you couldn't fly there without getting a weather report. And of course the GPO were jammed and it was very difficult to get through. In fact, it took hours to get through to get this weather report. And when I eventually got through, and I had about six airplanes going in all different directions around the country to return to base, I was asked to identify myself on the telephone, which I said, well, how do you do that? And they said, well, get someone else to speak and say who you are. So, I mean, it struck me as being a long way from the security to work, because I could have been in a telephone booth and anything could have happened. But, I suppose frightened was going a bit strong on the thing, but wondering what was going to happen next, I suppose, as the outbreak of war. But thinking it could not last very long, as the bombing would certainly write off everything. But, of course, this proved quite wrong on the thing.
You expected some kind of bombing knockout blow?
From us to the other side, of course. You know, with our bombers dropping these huge 500-pound bombs, as they were in those days, which, of course, you're lucky if you knock down the house, talk about knock down the city. But that's it.
So you're on the Blenheim night fighters. Yeah. Can you tell me something about what that was like?
Well, that, of course, flying at night we didn't have any of the aids around nowadays. And one had to find oneself around the countryside and in all sorts of weathers. It was a very dicey occupation. There was no radar or anything on the aircraft, so finding an enemy aircraft was almost impossible. We never did anything, really and truly. It was a waste of time. The squadron I was in were very fortunate. As my flight commander, who was then Flight Lieutenant Rosier, used to make us go off in bad weather in the dual aircraft, and just as you were putting your hand down to pull up the levers to pull the wheels up, he would pull the throttle back, so you were on one engine, and he did this continuously, and it was very frightening, no doubt about that, and one didn't look forward to this trip at all. But by God, we never lost a pilot through an engine failure. So it proves, because the engines were cutting out quite a lot in Blenheims in those days. And it just shows what training can do. We never lost one pilot in 229 squadron from that. But we didn't have any success, really, on the thing, because you're chasing, you're chasing stars half the time.
Did you ever come close to an enemy bomber?
Not really, no. We did convoy patrols as well off the East Coast, but we never did anything. No.
What did you think to the Blenheim as a fighting aircraft at that stage of the war?
No good at all. It was built as a bomber, of course, and they put some guns on the thing. And they weren't successful on that at all, on night fighting, without any aids. No, quite impossible. And we then moved to Hurricanes in February 1940. That in itself is quite a story, because the Hurricanes, we heard that we were going to change over, but a squadron gave up their old Hurricanes when they were re-equipped with new ones, and these old ones were flown into Digby, and we had to fly them without any dual or any dual aircraft of any sort. Having been trained on twin-engine aircraft, well, we hadn't flown a single-engine aircraft since the days of the Tiger Moth, and there we were with these Hurricane. Anyway, all went well on that, and within about a week or 10 days, we were operational.
What did you think of the Hurricane?
Well, we liked the Hurricane immensely, but I must say that the first trip was disappointing, because we all thought that Hurricane and Spitfire pilots were the be-all and end-all, and all these fit chaps flying these aircraft, and they always shot a bit of a line and told you that if you took too long getting your undercarriage up, you'd never find the aerodrome again, the speed they were supposed to get. But in practice, and in fact, the bomber, the Blenheim Mark 1 that we had, empty, you see, almost, with just five guns on it, four underneath and one in one wing, but no bombs on or anything like that. It was very light. When you opened up those two engines, you really got a jerk. It took off much better than the Hurricane.
And what kind of duties were you doing, first of all, with the Hurricanes?
From Digby, we were doing convoy patrols off the East Coast.
How were they carried out?
We would go and do a convoy patrol straight from Digby, land at an airfield near the coast, and spend the day there, and then come back to base. Well, when we started, come back to base before dark.
Would you just circle around the convoy?
I'd just circle around the convoy. And problem was then that radio was so bad, you see, you didn't have any conversation, you were in communications with anyone, you see. But I should tell you, I think, that coming back after a week of having these hurricanes, 10 days to be exact, we had a call from our sector telling us that there were bandits they thought bandits coming into the area, and this was just before dusk. So a flight commander, who was bringing six of us back from Digby, from Northcote's village to Digby, decided to go back out to sea to check on if there was anybody around. We didn't see anybody, and by the time we got back to Digby, it was pitch black. And there were six of us in the air, having never flown a hurricane at night before. As usual, all went well on the first landing. And we had been flying at night in the Blenheim, and we had a certain amount of experience, but it's a mighty different thing with the engine right out in front of you, and you couldn't see because of the exhaust stubs. Later, they were covered for the night flying. And anyway, we all got down safely, and the next day we were made operational day and night. Well, that's it, really.
Well, did the enemy often attack the East Coast convoys when you were patrolling?
Not during my time, no. Other people chased the field, but we didn't have any success, no. And we never had a convoy attacked, to my knowledge.
You moved to RAF Hawkinge, I think, in May 1940. That was for the Battle for France, was it?
That's not... We didn't move in... Well, to Hawkinge, we... one flight went off to France when the Hurricanes were being sent out to help to relieve... Well, help out there because of all the problems they had with lack of aircraft. And, of course, it was... We didn't know, but we followed a few days later with the other flight. We stopped at Hawkinge to refuel, and we were stopped from going to France. That was obviously, from what one has read since, when Lord Dowding had his showdown with everybody on the thing about sending hurricanes to France. And no more, as far as I know, went off to France. We stayed there, and we operated from Hawkinge for a short period over France.
In what kind of area did you operate?
Well, north and the... Going in about, well, I don't find, say 100 miles into France and going north and east and doing a sweep like that. An interesting time there for us, anyway, as well as there, some transporter, civilian transport aircraft were taking spares to Merville in France. And we had the job of escorting them. We were told in our briefing that we could go with these airplanes that were flying at about 120 miles an hour, and we were sort of circling them going out. When we got to Merville, we were to stay there for about 10 minutes, because that's all we could with the fuel that we used doing all this in, and bring back any of the transport that had thrown their stuff out and unloaded. Well, whilst going around there and not being pretty green at that time and not having much idea about enemies, we were attacked by 109s. And a fair old schmozzle went on there. That was the first time I had ever fired my guns on a hurricane.
Can you describe in detail from what you remember of that?
Well, we were... Suddenly we saw these airplanes coming at us, and we were just going around and around the airfield as if it was a peacetime, you see, a thing that would not happen later in the war. They jumped us, and they must have been greener than we were, because from people on the ground and the number of airplanes that were shot down, I think we lost about two or three, and the people on the ground claimed that 12 airplanes hit the ground around the airfield, you know, within sight anyway. I myself saw a 109 for the first time in my life, and I was trying to shoot this thing down and busy concentrating on that when a colleague, a chappy called Doug Edgell, came up behind me and shot one down that was shooting at me. So it was a fair old deal there. Anyway, most of us came back, and a couple of our chaps had bailed out anyway, and they came back later. But we did lose, I can't really say now, but we only lost about one or two, something like that, out of the 12. Not there, one, I think, out of the 12, and the rest came back. And that was our introduction, really, into warfare and bullets floating around. That was early May 40.
How soon after the German attack do you think that would have been? Because the German attack was on the 10th of May.
Well, it was shortly after that. Merville was quite a little way down, and it was certainly there, because...
How do you spell Merville? Is it M-E-R or M-E-U?
M-E-R-V-I-L-L-E, I think. I'm not quite sure about the E, but I think so.
We hear from the troops who were at Dunkirk a great deal of criticism of the RAF for allegedly not being there.
Yes.
What do you feel about that?
Well, I can understand that, really, on the set of it. But I certainly didn't understand it at the time. And as far as we were concerned, we were working flat out. To give an example, we had moved to Biggin Hill as a squadron, or the remnants of a squadron, really, because we hadn't got all our chaps back from ourselves into the squadron who came out of France, minus their aircraft. But we joined with other squadrons there, and to give you an example, one day, right at the beginning of Dunkirk, really, or in a few days of the start, we set off from Biggin Hill at first light, or just as it was getting light. And we'd done three trips to Dunkirk by 10 o'clock in the morning, and we were at Manston, where we used to land, you see, the nearest point to there, out on the airfield, were four of us out of the 12 airplanes that had started. And I shall always remember this getting terribly tired. I'd lost a roommate on that particular day, that morning, and it was our first introduction of losing people, and you weren't battle-hardened at all to anything like that. And I think it was the worst period of the war for all of us on the thing. We had a little field telephone there, and when it rang, we all thought, oh, they must be sending us back to base. And the CO put the phone down. He was still with us, and he said, OK, then put the phone down. And he said, come on, chaps, we've got to go again. And four of us went once more. Most of the time, we didn't reach Dunkirk. We were attacked on the way there, or we attacked bombers on the way there. And my own experience at that time, right at the start, and don't forget, we weren't war-hardened or anything at all, not as much as the Germans were, really, from the Spanish stuff and whatnot. And we were on our way to Dunkirk, and probably halfway there, when I saw these little balls going over my starboard wingtip, and looked around, and I was being attacked by 2 110s, measurement 110s, and we'd been told to do a steep climbing turn to the right to get away from this, you see, which I did, and I suppose very ham-fistedly, there was a bang, and I was sure I was hit, without any doubt about that. And I went straight into a spin. I started to undo my straps to jump out, and all I could see was water underneath. And the airplane didn't look too damaged to me anywhere. But I was spinning, and I spun from probably 16 or 17 or 18,000 feet down to 9 when the airplane came out. I came out right on the back, right behind, rather, two JU-88s. I had a bang at one of them. I'm convinced that I hit it, all right, because I stopped the gunner firing anyway on the thing. But I didn't see it go down. We had great difficulty in those days with just ball ammunition. You've possibly heard this from other people.
What was the problem with it?
Well, it was just plain .303 ammunition. You see, when we got the DeWild later, things began to happen. But you had to hit an oil pipe or something like that to do any damage. You damaged the airplane, but you didn't stop it flying. That was a problem. Anyway, we came home from that, and I got home from that, and I tried to land this airplane very gingerly, thinking I'd been hit, you see, from going into my spin, which I did with it. There was a tremendous bang, or at least I thought so. I landed the airplane, I got out, and I started crawling around underneath to see where the holes were, and I couldn't find one, so I wasn't hit at all. It was a high-speed stall that I'd done. And
whereabouts was that incident, do you think?
Halfway to Dunkirk.
Over France?
Well, we were over the sea. Well, yeah. We also, I mean, I should say, from all the trips we did in that short period, we didn't get over Dunkirk all that number of times. A few times, but not all that lot. And we were very high if we did get over there, anyway, trying to get these bombers. You asked me about how did we feel about it. We had one pilot who'd bailed out twice. I think forced landed once, possibly, but anyway, came back twice from there. Fortunately, he didn't tell us, and we didn't really know how the army were reacting. When he was booed as he came down the gangplank at Dover, you see. But he told us when the thing was all over. But we were absolutely tired out. We didn't have any airplanes. It took 3 squadrons to make up a squadron to go. And it was a very rough time for us, I can assure you.
When you were over Dunkirk, what did it look like, the beaches?
Well, you saw crowds of troops there when you could see, and there was this big pillar of smoke coming up. I mean, you could see that from miles away, you see. Well, there were boats and people on the ground. There were thousands of troops on the beaches, it was all. And you were just hoping that they could get off. But how they could get off, I mean, what did it look like? It looked absolutely impossible to get people out of there. And I've never thought any other than how amazing it is they got so many out.
What did you feel about the capabilities of the Hurricane in a dogfight with the ME-109?
Well, I had great confidence in the Hurricane. The 109 was faster. It could always run away from you. You know, we were in trouble when we were attacked by 109 if we couldn't run away. You had this, we could turn inside them, but the whole system of air fighting, as far as I'm concerned, if you see them first at a reasonable distance away, you stand a chance of surviving. Anyway, but the Hurricane was a marvellous airplane to fly, and it was so rugged. And you could turn it on a sixpence, you see. And I don't know, I think we all had confidence in the thing. But, of course, the 109's guns were better, they were bigger. They had the cannons before you did, and they were faster, that's all I can say. The only thing I could say, competing with the Germans on that, they were equally as good or even better in lots of cases, I suppose, in pilots, and their aircraft was equally as good, I think. But they're so disciplined that if they found one squadron attacking from the port side, they would go home and train 3 days to say the British would attack from the port side, you see. And when they came next time, they'd meet a different squadron who came in from somewhere else, because frankly we didn't know where we were going in. And this was when the thing, I'm on a bit from Dunkirk now, I'm really when the bombers were coming over this country, it was just the luck of the draw where you happened to be when they came in, coming in. And their military training and discipline, I think, tied them down. They weren't flexible enough, but that's just my idea.
Did you see anything of the French or Belgian Air Force over France?
No. No. Because we were only on the north side there anyway, to be fair to them.
Was there any German aircraft which you felt that you particularly liked to attack, which was easy meat?
Well, the Ju-87, I suppose, was the easiest one that we've found, yes. The others, you see, they were good and they were strong and they covered one another very well.
Did you have any successes over France? Did you shoot any down, do you think?
Well, the only time really was the one I described at Merville. Now, whether that went down or not, I don't know. And, of course, I don't know about the Ju-88 at Dunkirk. We had another go at one at Dunkirk when the smoke, you asked me about that, over the Dunkirk itself. I found myself alone over there, and I was up the top of, towards the top of the smoke coming up, and a German came out. So I had a crack at it, and it went back in again, and I whistled around the other side, and it was coming out down below, and I saw another Hurricane and a Gladiator. The sole Gladiator, I think, that was out there in that time, who it was or what, or I don't know. And they were both going at this thing, certainly hitting it, but it was still flying. And I had about three goes at it. It turned out that in the Hurricane was my own squadron commander, when we discussed it later.
Who was he?
Well, he was then squadron leader H.J. McGuire. He's now Air Marshal, Sir Harold McGuire. And he came back and ordered me to go and check the lineup of his guns. You know, he thought there was something wrong, but I'm sure there weren't. But we had a lot of trouble in those early days. I think you'll find from anybody you speak to that you had to hit a vital part of this airplane to bring it down, whereas, you know, get a fire from a petrol tank or something like that, or from pipelines, where otherwise they staggered along with and got back, I think, anyway.
Can you take the narrative a bit further, please, as it affected you?
What
happened to you next?
Coming on from Dunkirk. Well, I think, just to finish that one off, that May 1940, we were so weary, you know, after Dunkirk, that we were a liability, really, flying airplanes. Without a doubt. I came back from France on one occasion there, and it could be nothing but tiredness. We had been warned not to go too far west if you were coming back on your own after something had happened. Well, I was coming back because I had engine trouble, oil trouble. And I came back and I thought, I must steer a bit north, you know, I mustn't go too far west because if I miss Cornwall, I'm in trouble. And I came across what was a lot of sea after I left the French coast. And eventually, in my own mind, tired mind, I thought, well, I've come across it, that wide bit down by Southampton. And like an idiot, when I saw the English coast, instead of turning, checking where I was, then, first of all, I just turned right to go back, I think it was to go back to Hawkins Inn on the thing. And suddenly, when I couldn't recognise anything, I began to check up a bit more, and I found myself really north of the Thames going up the... And I eventually landed at Horsham St. Faith. It was an airfield that wasn't working at all, and I had to take off from there with practically no fuel and go to Coltishall, which is just up the way, where I refilled and went back to Hawking. To go back, just to illustrate the point of tiredness, you had to go back over north, around London. You couldn't come back on the east side of London. We were drilled on this, really, because they'd send people up, you know, in a panic of a fear, didn't know what it was. So we had to come back to the west and then down to Hawkins, and I landed there. And I was greeted when I got back with